if the worst happens and the destructive firepower of the Russian army were to engulf Ukraine's towns and cities, I shudder to contemplate the tragedy that would ensue.
Yeah, yeah.
And the bloodshed comparable to the first war in Chechnya or Bosnia.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson avoiding talking about illegal Downing Street parties by talking about Ukraine. As of now, tens of thousands of Russian troops are deployed near Ukraine's borders. Russia denies that it will invade, and America threatens that if it does, the US will unleash massive economic sanctions. But to what end? Nicholas Milder is Assistant Professor of History at Cornell University and author of Economic Weapon, The Rise of Sanctions as a Tool of Modern War. He joins me now. No war yet, Nick. Is the threat of sanctions part of what's holding the line?
At the moment, I think it's difficult to say because there isn't yet real clarity about which sanctions would be imposed if Russia were to escalate, and also what exactly would count as an escalation. We've been for a few years now already in the situation that some people have called gray zone warfare. And sanctions themselves, in a way, are also difficult to classify because light sanctions are clearly not very invasive, but heavy sanctions do actually get close to being acts of war in certain situations. So it's kind of uncertain is the short answer.
Well, I think Congress the other day, or certainly a member of Congress the other day, was talking about the mother of all sanctions, and the Biden administration has been threatening to use them since December when this began. How able would Russia be to deal with a suite of sanctions?
So we'll have to see what will happen when sanctions and if sanctions get imposed. In the end, we can't really say precisely beforehand, but it would appear that sanctions at the moment would have less effect than they had previously. Russia has been better prepared at the moment than it was 8 years ago when the first Western sanctions were imposed. It's done a number of things in the meantime. It's built up very large foreign exchange reserves. It's created a domestic alternative payment system for use within the country. It's also moved its agricultural and food production onto a more self-sufficient footing. And it's taken a number of other measures to make sure that it has to rely less on issuing international debt. And all of those things, I think, put together mean that the Russian economy right now is more resilient against sanctions than it was 8 years ago. And it's also the sanctions that have been in effect in the last 8 years that have contributed to that, because Russian policymakers have effectively been able to use those sanctions as a kind of stress test for the bits of their financial system and the bits of their economy that they're trying to insulate against sanctions.
Well, I'll get in a moment to really the meat of the book you've written, which is kind of how we got here and the rise of sanctions. But they are now, or they have been for a while, part of the international relations toolkit for countries like the US and also the EU. How effective are they more generally these days?
On the whole, I think you can see that sanctions have, as they have been used more and more, actually gotten less effective at changing the behavior of their targets. And it's definitely true that sanctions, when you impose them particularly on weaker and smaller countries, countries that are less economically developed, have really significant economic effects. I think you can see this right now in Afghanistan, for example, where after the withdrawal of Western troops in August, almost without a debate, really almost reflexively and impulsively, the United States government chose to freeze the assets of the Afghan government. But it's one thing to impose severe economic costs. Those effects, I think, are undeniable. But it's quite another to actually translate that sort of economic effect into political efficacy, into achieving the political goals that you want to reach. That's much harder, and at that, sanctions have proven much less effective.
Just while I think of it, Nick, because I'm of the right age for this, were sanctions not effective in the 1980s in putting pressure on South Africa's apartheid regime?
Yes, sanctions were a very important part of the campaign against apartheid South Africa, and it definitely had some effect. However, in that case, there were some other factors that also played a role, particularly in the timing of when the apartheid regime chose to surrender. Historians who've looked into this now also think that a large part of the answer was the fact that the Cold War ended, and that made it possible for de Klerk, particularly, to make these overtures and dismantle the regime and move forward into multiracial democracy without having as big a cost attached to it and this fear of communism, which was there during the Cold War. And the other thing to remember is, about South Africa is that it was actually put under sanctions already by many countries going back to the 1940s or 50s. So they definitely played a role, but it was a very long-winded affair.
Not a quick fix. Nick, obviously you're a historian and your book, Economic Weapon, The Rise of Sanctions as a Tool of Modern War, really unpacks it all at length. But briefly, how long have we had sanctions? When did they begin?
The origins of sanctions go back to about a century ago, and it's really the period around World War I, which is when they were created. And what that really prompted among Europeans was the sense that they needed to find a new instrument that they could use, international organizations could use, in order to prevent a repetition of a war that terrible. And what they found was that the instrument that they had used during the war, economic blockade, could actually be taken out of wartime and then reapplied in peacetime. And that's really the origin of economic sanctions. And the first organization that had that power was the League of Nations. And in the interwar period, it was really the first moment in the last 100 years and in modern history that policymakers tried to use economic pressure to prevent wars breaking out between states. So in that sense, the whole confrontation with Russia right now is really back to the original classic purpose of sanctions, which is to prevent conflict between countries.
Of course, the intention of preventing war did not stop what happened at the end of the 30s with World War II occurring. In fact, there are people who argue that part of why Japan got into the war when it did was because of the sanctions America was placing on it.
Yes, exactly. And that's an important thing that went wrong in the 1930s, because sanctions and their chances of success, history shows, really depend on the moment and the particular circumstances in economic history and in the development of the world economy. Some moments are much more propitious, much more suitable for the use of sanctions, and they're much more likely to make sanctions work than others. And in the 1930s, there had just been a major global depression, and it was the Great Depression that really weakened the power of sanctions. And the reason was that many countries, in response to the depression, turned towards economic nationalism, protectionism. They became much more inward-looking, so they were already much more inclined to distrust each other. And when you then start to threaten countries with further pressure, with further isolation, you don't actually make them restrain their behavior, you make them more aggressive, you make them likely to search for more ways of becoming independent. And that is very much what happened with Italy, fascist Italy under Mussolini, and also to some degree with Nazi Germany and with Japan, yes.
When do we get to the point post-war, in fact significantly post-war, I think, when the US started really using sanctions? Is that a reflection of just their inexorable rise in economic power, or is it that plus the fact that so many instruments that make this possible are kind of within their purview?
So the United States is in a very interesting country in this case, because they weren't always that enthusiastic about sanctions. And actually, during this interwar period, when the League of Nations and European countries were very much trying to use sanctions to preserve world peace, the United States really remained on the sideline. And it's only in the 1940s, as you mentioned, when they began to rise into their current really global hegemonic role, that they started to look with a new, fresh eye towards sanctions. And that was possibly also because they had a much bigger economic heft. Their currency, the US dollar, then became the global reserve currency. And as a result, there were many more levers now available to people in the American state to try and influence behavior of other countries. So during the Cold War, there was an increasing role for sanctions. But really, the moment when they exploded into their current omnipresence and their current high frequency of use was after the end of the Cold War. So the 1990s and the 2000s, that's really when the modern popularity of sanctions took root.
Now, what we have seen this century, though, is that kind of the inexorable move towards globalization has been challenged by things like the rise of nationalism, which we were talking about earlier, and more recently, of course, the pandemic. How have those things affected the usefulness of sanctions?
So those shocks are very much an interesting parallel between today and the interwar period. And I think that's what makes this history really worth studying, because we have a period to compare it with. And the 2008 financial crisis and global recession, and then the recent COVID recession, have made globalization and the world economy a bit more brittle. We experience this right now, right, in the supply chain crises and problems that we have, and in all sorts of other ways, the chip shortage. And sanctions in this context also are both more difficult to use, because countries are less willing to endanger the interdependence that still exists, but they also actually aggravate some of these problems when you do use them. So the effect actually of, for example, American sanctions on Huawei, the Chinese telecoms communications company, in 2019 was that Huawei became very scared it would be cut off from access to semiconductors. And it began in a kind of panic to buy up semiconductor components all over the world. And that's one of the contributing factors to the chip shortage that we've had now for several months.
Are there ways, Nick, I know you're not an economist, you're an historian, but are there ways of using economics or financial instruments that work in terms of getting what you want in foreign policy terms?
I definitely think that there are instruments, and some of those might also include actually more positive inducements than sanctions. One of the things that we've seen in the last few years also is the really march around the world of China's Belt and Road Initiative. And I think that that actually contains a lesson for the West in how we too can actually garner more influence in certain countries. And that's that you can more easily obtain influence when you provide resources and funding than when you withhold them and deprive countries of them. And maybe that's also something that we can do now, not just to alleviate humanitarian crises caused by sanctions like in Afghanistan, but also in the case of Ukraine. One of the real big problems for Ukraine, and the thing that makes it very difficult for them to defend themselves at the moment, is that they really have been suffering from at least two decades now of economic stagnation. Their income level has really not developed at all much since the 1990s, and they really lack, as a result of the threat of war, but also corruption and underinvestment, a solid domestic infrastructure base. Economic growth and incomes are very low. Ukraine's gotten a lot of military aid, and there's talk of more of that, but what it also really needs in the long run is substantial economic aid. And this is also one of the things that a famous economist like John Maynard Keynes actually proposed in the 1920s and 30s. He said, focus more on providing positive assistance to the victims of aggression and to countries in need, and less on negative punishment of the aggressor. That way you also create a more positive dynamic in the world economy, and you ultimately stimulate trade, and you keep globalization more intact.
That, I think, is a good place to wrap this up. Nick, thank you very much for joining us today on The Money.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on.
Nicholas Smilder is the author of Economic Weapon, The Rise of Sanctions as a Tool of Modern War. And I think we'll do a bit more on economic history. It has a bit of value.